Good morning, everybody. This is Melissa Merson, the Communications Director at CBO. Thank you for participating in our call this morning. Our new report, Evaluating Military Compensation, was posted on our website this morning at cbo.gov if anyone doesn't have it. This morning, CBO Director Peter Orszag will make a few remarks about the new report. Following that, the Deputy Assistant Director of our National Security Division, Matt Goldberg, we'll walk you through the key points in the report. After he's concluded, we'll be happy to take your questions. If you would like to ask a question, please indicate by pressing *1 on your keypad. If you decide for some reason you don't want to ask your question or someone else has asked it for you, then please press *2, and that will remove you from the question queue. You will be recognized in order to ask your questions. And with that, let me present CBO Director Peter Orszag.
Thank you, Melissa. I will be brief. One of the various factors that affect whether people join the military is the compensation that is offered for military positions relative to civilian positions. And for that reason, the Senate Budget Committee asked us to review the level of military compensation, especially focusing on active duty enlisted personnel, and in particular in comparison to the civilian sector. So to summarize the results, I'm going to turn it over to Matt, who will run through what we found, and then we'll take questions. Matt.
Okay, good morning. This is Matt Goldberg. We put out a report this morning. There's been a lot of interest for many years in military compensation, and comparing military compensation to what military folks could have gotten in the civilian world to make sure that the pay is fair, to make sure that, in particular since the wars have been going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, to make sure that military personnel are adequately compensated for the family separation, the hardships, and other risks that they've been facing. There's actually been a movement, a legislative movement, even prior to the war in Iraq. Several aspects of military pay were made more generous. The military retirement system was revised in 2000. The redux reforms that would have cut military retirement pay were repealed. The original retirement formula was restored. In other words, TRICARE for Life was implemented in 2002 as a wraparound to Medicare to provide health care for the retirees generally over age 65. And in the current Congress, there's still interest. The House has passed their version of the National Defense Authorization Act for 2008, and it has not yet passed the corresponding measure. With the benchmark that's often used for setting the military pay raise every year is the Employment Cost Index, or the ECI. It's a measure of compensation in the civilian sector. What the House version of the Authorization Act would do for 2009 through 12 would be to mandate military pay raise as a half percentage point above the ECI. One of the problems is in trying to compare military pay to civilian pay. Military pay is much richer in benefits. If you just look at the basic pay, you're not getting a full understanding of what military members are receiving. And there's often a discussion of the pay gap. The pay gap is basically a cumulative comparison since 1982 between the increases in military basic pay and the increases in the ECI, the civilian measure. We've also looked at a more comprehensive measure of military compensation called the RMC, Regular Military Compensation, which includes not only basic pay but also cash allowances for food and housing, as well as an imputation to recognize that the food and housing allowances are not subject to federal income tax. The so-called pay gap measure, which compares just military basic pay to the ECI, still shows the military pay lagging by about 5% relative to the ECI in terms of the cumulative increases since 1982. However, if you look at regular military compensation, this broader measure that includes allowances, actually military pay appears to have caught up and exceeded. Notice the pay gap seems to have been eliminated if you use the broader measure of military pay. Another way to look at it is not just the cumulative increases in military versus civilian pay, but in terms of the level. Let's just look at 2006. It's been the policy, the stated policy of the Department of Defense for several years, and it was reiterated in testimony this year by Undersecretary Chu. The Department's policy is that the broader measure of compensation, the so-called RMC, should be set at a level equal to the 70th percentile or better of civilian pay. 70th percentile meaning that military pay should be higher than the civilian pay for 70% of the civilian population, but not as high as 100% of the population. And that's done when you equalize the comparison for education and age and experience. One thing that's noteworthy is that in 2005, 72% of enlisted members in the military had at least one year of college completed. Most enlisted recruits do not have college. They're often coming straight out of high school. But while they're in the service, they accumulate college credits. And almost three-quarters of them had at least a year of college credit in the active duty force. And in fact, 6% of the force has earned a four-year degree. And so the correct comparison is probably between military pay and the pay of civilians who have some, at least some college and not necessarily a four-year degree. The DoD's goal, as I said, was to pay at the 70th percentile relative to the civilian population. And it appears in FY06, by our estimates, that military pay was about the 75th percentile. So DoD, in that sense, has made their goal. The comparisons are difficult to make because the jobs are very different. Obviously, the military service, particularly in a war zone, is much more dangerous than almost any civilian job. There's family separation, as I mentioned earlier. Even in peacetime in the U.S., there's military discipline. There's being on call at all times. Makes military life different from civilian life. So any pay comparison is fundamentally imperfect, and in the end, the best measure is probably whether or not the military can fill their slots. If they're filling the slots, then you could say, economists would say, pay is adequate. And for the most part, the military has been filling their slots. Several of the services, notably the Army in 2005, didn't meet their recruiting goals, but the Army's recovered in 2006 and basically met their goals. And so it appears that, broadly speaking, the military is filling their positions, not in every occupation. And the challenge will be in the future, because both the Army and the Marine Corps are scheduled to increase their end strength, the size of their force, and that will present challenges to the military and require constant attention to the comparability of and adequacy of military pay. I think at this point we're ready to turn over to questions and answers.
Again, if you wish to ask a question of Peter or Matt, please press *1 on your keypad. We'll give you a moment to do that. Then we'll recognize anyone in turn. All right, we're going to start with Megan Scully.
Great. Thanks for the presser today. Wanted to touch base in terms of costs, particularly as the Army and Marine Corps increase their sizes. Long-term costs for military compensation and benefits, do you see that, you know, kind of taking on a larger part of the Defense Department's budget? And if so, how does that put then a squeeze on other areas of the budget?
Yes, Megan, we've looked at this, and in fact, we have another report that we put out in 2006 that addresses some of those questions very directly. We do see military compensation as taking over a larger share of the budget, and we have specific estimates in our October 2006 report called Long-Term Implications of Current Defense Plans. Anytime the ECI, which is often the benchmark for military pay raises, generally rises faster than the CPI, and if the authorization passes with the House language and the military pay raises are half percentage point above the ECI, then there'll continue to be real pay increases for military personnel, as well as health benefits and retirement benefits, which have gotten more generous, as I mentioned, since about 99 or 2000. So there is going to be a bit of a squeeze on other parts of the department, like acquisition programs, and that's something that the DOD, not speaking for them, but I've heard in testimony that DOD is very conscious of, and in particular, that's one reason they're trying to hold down the growth in healthcare benefits so that they don't eat into procurement programs.
Any idea in terms of the end strength increases for the Army and Marine Corps? I'm not sure if this is anything you've looked at, but what that then could eventually mean in terms of dollar figures in the out years for pay and compensation.
We did a report to Senator Levin on precisely that question, and if I can find the numbers for you quickly. We have military personnel costs going up by 2013 on the order of $5 billion a year associated with the end strength increases for the Army.
Okay. And it's just Army?
She asked whether that was just Army.
Okay.
That's the Army number.
Right. Thank you.
Our next question will be from Rick Mays, and just hold on a second. Your mic will go live. There you go.
Well, this is Rick Mays with the Army Times. I have a question about the options that you have in the report because I don't understand what one of them does. One of them is basically to lump basic pay, housing allowance, and subsistence allowance into one area and cap it, and I understand how that saves a little bit of money. The second one that I understand is to do away with the difference between dependents and not dependent rates, which costs money because you're raising the money. But I don't understand what the third one does. You're talking about putting all of military compensation into a single appropriation. Well, yeah. What does that do? I mean, people already know by adding up the personnel and O&M costs what the amount of money is. I'm not sure what you think is accomplished by a consolidation of the appropriations.
Sure. Well, I would argue that people don't know everything that's spent because some of the operations and maintenance money goes for personnel-related functions, but the O&M is such a big pot of money that it's not clear exactly how much of it is going can be attributed as a personnel cost and how much of it goes to, say, flying hours or something else. And so the idea is that two things mainly. One is that when there's talk about what the pay raise should be, that lawmakers have a more comprehensive view of how much is actually getting paid, regardless of which pot of money it comes out of. Actually, three things. That's one. A second is that the service members would have some appreciation for some of the other benefits that are paid out of other pots of money and don't necessarily show up in their paycheck. And finally, when decisions are made within the Pentagon as to, for example, end strength or how many people to plan to man a new ship, for example, we want the people who make those decisions within the Pentagon to be fully aware of all the costs of personnel so they can make the right trade-offs between people, machines, automation, and those kind of things.
So you think they're going to say, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money, and then think twice? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's the suggestion.
Okay. Thanks.
There's no one else lined up in the queue right now. Does anyone else want to ask a question? If so, second shots or... press *1 if you'd like to. We'll give it another minute, and then somebody want to line up to ask a question, please press *1 on your keypad. Okay. Jay, I'm going to promote you into the queue. One moment. Jay Dorn. You're on, Jay. Jay? Sorry. Sounds like we're having a small technical problem. And now he's gone. Okay. Anybody else want to ask a question? All right. Well,
There aren't any further questions. This is Peter Orszag again. We just wanted to thank you for joining us. And if you do have any other follow-up questions, feel free to get in touch. The right point of contact would probably be Melissa Merson at 226-2602. And thank you all for joining us. Bye.
Thanks, Matt.